Europe is complicated. Why are Donald Tusk and Jean-Claude Juncker so similar? Previously in Europe, Russia's Eurovision entry. And this week we're going to be talking about the UK, the United Kingdom, a bit, because a handful of things happened. First thing to talk about would be something that a lot of you no doubt saw in the news yourselves, but we'll cover it here because we'd be remiss not to mention it. There was a shooting and stabbing terrorist attack outside of Westminster Parliament, the centre of the UK government, there on Wednesday just past. A handful of arrests have been made, and the suspect has been named. So thought we'd just mention that quickly.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of sources on this if you guys want to go out there. Just because this is something that commonly gets mentioned when an attack like this happens, we do want to point out that has been released that the terrorist was a British-born citizen from Birmingham, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
So, yeah, a lot of people have been saying, without a lot of evidence, that it was a refugee or an immigrant, and we just want to say that that's not what the authorities are saying.
Yep, and they've released his name, so, like, people can figure out who this person is. Not anymore. Yeah, so this was, I think four people died, five people died, I think, now is the... someone
20
died
injured.
Yeah, about 20 or so injured. Parliament was shut down for the day, I guess. A lot of central London was shut down. Mm-hmm. London centre being sufficiently big that a lot of people probably didn't notice if they weren't looking at the news. Because Westminster is quite far away from a lot of other stuff. It's like where I work. Didn't affect me.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I guess this is kind of, you know, will continue to develop. I believe there was a string of arrests the following day. I believe there's one person still in custody after that now. Mm-hmm. It was two yesterday. I think they released another one of them. But it's not particularly clear like what the arrests were specifically in reference to, like were they known associates or were they kind of other people being watched for various reasons. It's not clear why that was the case. Anyway, there's not really much more we can talk about on that.
Nope.
I guess kind of related, but actually not related at all.
It happened in the UK.
It happened in the UK. The UK have done a similar thing to the US and that they've banned large electronics on flights from six majority Muslim countries. It's inbound flights only. You can't bring anything that's basically bigger than a phone. So like laptops, tablets, sufficiently large phones all have to go in your whole baggage. So I think the countries are Turkey, Lebanon, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Tunisia, which is kind of like, you know, countries that most of which the UK has quite good relationships with. The general like thinking from people kind of privy to, you know, security policy is that this is probably a specific reaction to a foil plot or a plot that they subsequently got knowledge of after it didn't work out or was cancelled, relating to a way to get something through the sensors that could be could be a bomb or conceal weapons.
Yeah,
in a piece of electronics. Because anyone who's gone through an airport in the last 10 years would know that the going through security, like they make you take your laptop out separately from your bag and put it in a separate tray in a lot of airports, so it gets scanned specifically. Mm-hmm. I guess there must have been something quite specific on one of these targeted airlines, and the fact that it's only incoming flights is kind of, this is more like an implication that there is some distrust in the Foreign Office in the UK of the airport staff in those countries not being reliable, as opposed to anything else. Because it's not like the wording from the like gov.uk announcement of this is very much like people should continue to fly to these countries. This isn't a discouragement to that. Mm-hmm. It's very much this is an extra security precaution we're doing. The kind of like it's kind of a strange one because they're not saying you can't fly with these objects. It's that you have to put them in your hold baggage.
Yeah.
However, like the by all accounts, things in your hold baggage are like, if anything, less thoroughly screened than stuff in your carry-on baggage. Because in your carry-on baggage, it's quite trivial to search someone's bag and take something out and look at an object physically. Whereas for the hold baggage, that's actually quite like everything goes through like a scanner, but it's not the same way that you can like quite easily open and rifle through stuff.
Yeah, I mean, to a certain extent, you can kind of determine what the threat was
mm-hmm.
that they're basing this ban off. Like, it was obviously done through a like reasonably small but reasonably large electronic device, a portable one. It had to be like the attempt was to do something mid-flight. Like the attempt was like the device also required like some sort of hand activation, in-person activation. So the fact that they're like, oh, I can go into the hold and it's fine. And like all these things are quite telling. And I'm sure there's people who work in these kind of industries being like, I know exactly what they're talking about, but like, no, not to say it and things like that.
Yeah. I think like a common criticism from security researchers oft or like kind of experts in the field is that a lot of airport security is like airport security for show in a lot of ways, because anytime there's a test done to see like to test the security reliability of like, oh, if I try to sneak this thing on in this particular way, will it get found? Generally it's found that like most of the time you can get stuff on if you like really put effort into it and like think it through. However, it is a deterrent that it seems quite complicated and you would have to like do a lot of forward planning to sneak stuff through, I guess, in a certain way. But it's not like that security precautions when they introduce them like this are necessarily more reliable. It's very much like a temporary show of force that they can do it. I think people were like understandably angry at like the weird targeted nature of this. It's like the number of airlines that fly to the UK from those countries is a sufficiently small number of companies. So it's effectively like pointing to the organizations that run security for a handful of airports and a handful of airlines. It's like, we don't trust you and your ability to secure things.
When we talked about this last time, we were kind of, it was weird the handful of countries that they picked, because like Tunisia is on the list, and Tunisia is like a very reliable democratic ally of like a lot of Western European countries, including the UK. I can understand if people say their security isn't up to scratch, that's fine, but at the same time there is like Saudi Arabia, which is a very, very secure, like authoritarian kind of security precautions in their airports.
Yeah,
that they're a country that's very aware of the like kind of geopolitical neighborhood they're in, and because of that, their security is quite tight.
I think like the issue being pointed out, like that is the target of this particular measure is that. The issue isn't necessarily like, oh, because you can't bring like something over like a liquid over 100 mils on a plane in general. The issue would be that like, well, that means you're sure that there's no one being compromised in the airport security staff that would like hand something to a passenger on the other side of security is effectively like, that would be where the weak point would have to be for this to be like a necessary measure. If you get me, isn't to say like, well, if you're not supposed to have laptops at all, someone with a laptop is clearly a red flag, so they were handed that at some point, they shouldn't have gotten that through security. Whereas I guess if you're saying that like, oh, well, everything's been scanned, but like how sure are we that no one's just been handed something after the x-ray machine? It's a weird thing, which isn't, it's like, it's, you know, notably unclear what the deal with it is. Anyway.
Moving on to something else quite big and relatively expected that happened within the UK, is that the British government on Monday said it's going to trigger Article 50 on the 29th of March. When we talked about this earlier in the week, we kind of suspected that the terrorist attack had postponed this, but apparently that's not the case anymore. Wednesday of next week, 29th of March, is supposedly still going ahead to be the Article 50 trigger date. The official EU treaty exit clause will begin, and from that point, the UK has 2 years to leave the European Union.
I'm 90% sure that they specified an exact date previously, and they're now they've now just hush been like, oh no, we've set the date. This is the date, and be like, but the implication was that it was going to be mid March, not the very very end of March. But I feel like I remember there being a date floated.
We also a lot of critics have pointed out this is the 29th of March, and like, okay, there's the possibility they said mid-March, but they were always saying March. Really, yes. For a long time, we're saying March. And they're like, you're just scraping by. I mean, if you picked the 31st of March, that would have been a bit more, like, telling. But,
No, because I recall an initial concern was that it was going to clash with the Rome Declaration thing that happened during the week.
Yeah.
Which it didn't, but we knew it wasn't going to, and I feel like that was because they gave us a date, and then they quietly brushed away the date.
I feel like they said it just wouldn't be that day.
Yeah, maybe that could be.
But at the same time, I'm also thinking now, wouldn't 31st of March have been better? Because then you could have been like, because then you would have been given an exact and very clear date of when you would have been out of the European Union. It would have been April 1st, like 2019.
I feel like your implication here is that this is a thought through process of
or the greatest April Fool's joke.
And now to France, I guess, is the what we're going to talk about. Sorry, no, I was confused because Kieran mucked up the schedule of stuff to talk about.
I did not. It's French EU news.
Okay, sure. That's a topic. That's a coherent topic.
One of the founding members of the EU was France.
Sure. I think that's kind of a loose. Okay, fine. It's fine. It doesn't matter. there was a French election debate between all the major candidates, which was a reasonably big deal. It was like a marathon 3-hour debate on live on French television. Live translated into English as well, which was nice. There was a debate. Kieran, do you have any comments on it?
Sorry, I have some like kind of takeaways that I've gathered from it here. It's worth knowing that it was 3 hours debate, which seemed quite long, but it was a 6-way debate.
Yeah,
and in total talk time, because that's quite heavily monitored, if I'm not mistaken, that they like very much control how much everyone speaks.
Mm-hmm.
So that would have been about like a half an hour total speaking time for each candidate.
Yeah.
But obviously not consecutively.
Yeah.
Because that would have been maddening. Yeah.
I mean, that's what they did in the last UK general election. Instead of having actual debates, they had that stupid joint town hall thing where like one of them just came out and effectively talked for half an hour, then it would leave, and then subsequently the next one would come out and talk for half an hour and then would leave.
I mean, I think that's a fine idea, but also...
No, it's not. It's an awful idea. Have a debate.
No, you shouldn't. I think it's a fine idea, but not instead of a debate.
Yes.
I think it's a good idea to have, like, something everyone's paying attention to, and then this candidate just gets to announce their platform.
Oh, like, okay, I get you. I understand. I understand your point. Cool.
That makes sense, but not instead of a debate.
Yes.
Their platform should be at some point challenged.
Yeah, right.
Anyway... Some takeaways from the French debate were that Macron supposedly performed quite well, according to a lot of commentators. Yeah. He fended off his opponents and he held his own. This is like the first time he's done this because he founded his own party. He didn't have primaries, so we haven't seen this from him yet.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, though, other commentators said that he wasn't particularly wowing, that he didn't like have any kind of crazy wow moments, but he was strong, consistently strong, but nothing to write home about.
Sure.
Out of all the candidates, he was the only one to accuse Le Pen of lying. And this apparently threw her off balance of what people like saw. Another thing to note about Le Pen is that Le Pen avoided mentioning her controversial proposal to hold a referendum on EU membership, which is people found quite odd because that's kind of like one of the founding principles of her party.
Yeah, she also didn't. She also has kind of stopped mentioning, and this is in like campaign rallies and stuff. She's kind of stopped mentioning the wanting to get rid of the euro at all, kind of thing. Because it's now been around long enough. There's a lot of French pensioners whose pensions are in euros and stuff.
Yeah, that was always like a big asterisk to Euroscepticism in Eurozone countries.
Yes.
Yeah. People have kind of pointed out that English-speaking media have painted this wave of populist right parties as being like Eurosceptic parties, whereas you more accurately could describe them as Islamophobic parties who also happen to be Eurosceptic.
Yes, or like fiscally conservative, for instance, or
because people picking
another strong ideological position, not necessarily Euroscepticism, which just happens to be in the UK.
The people point to Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, which started as just a purely anti-Euro party, like against the currency. They weren't against the EU. But then when Pegida, that group kind of disbanded and all the anti-Islamists like went to that party and that party kind of became a shell for them. That was the only time that party got like a big shot in the arm in terms of numbers.
Yeah, right.
So it's an interesting one. Next is the other takeaway was that Fionn was like viewed favorably. Fionn's been in the news lately for a lot of his scandals and such, but at the same time, this is the first time he's been back on the like debate, and people are kind of reminding themselves of why they liked him to begin with.
Yeah.
He's very statesmanlike, he's good in debate, very presidential appearing. So people are like, oh yeah, okay, cool. So people are kind of saying once he's like in control of his own image, he looks quite good.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he's not, he doesn't.
Yeah, right.
Which is kind of interesting.
Mm.
So during the 3-hour debate, this is the last takeaway, there was a lot of time discussing France and Europe in the world, and plans, and people, the candidates discussed their plans for immigration, the migrant crisis. However, the whole election, the like debate as a whole, didn't really focus explicitly on the European Union.
Yeah.
This is also reminiscent of what a lot of takeaways from like people on the ground in the Dutch election were saying, that the like a lot of the English-speaking media in the wake of Brexit is painting the Dutch election as being all about the European Union, when to actual Dutch voters it wasn't.
Yes, yeah, right. Cool. So like a number of other things that happened kind of since, because the debate was Monday, Tuesday. It was early during the week. So things have happened since. One of which was the French Interior Minister, who's a socialist from the Socialist Party, was embroiled in a similar hiring family for not necessarily on legitimate grounds kind of thing, where.
Similar scandal to what Fionn was going through.
Yes, but I think that, like the Fionn, like really not even close to like serious like money amounts. I guess it was like he hired his daughters potentially as like for things they were doing, but kind of like as summer jobs for stuff that they weren't like necessary parliamentary staff. Let's say that's what the issue, the kind of main issue with it was, and he's resigned over this, saying that this shouldn't distract away from the work they have left to do in government. So any position that Fionn's campaign could really have taken to be like, see, look, the whole jobs scandal thing isn't that big a deal, everyone does it, and this guy resigns immediately, saying like, we shouldn't let's like, if there's an investigation, fine, but I don't want this to tarnish the government. And like, well Fionn is very much letting this tarnish the Conservative party's presidential hopes. So
that was funny.
Also, Fionn may be embroiled in another scandal where a report has linked him to taking payments of 50 grand to arrange meetings between a Lebanese businessman and Vladimir Putin and the head of Total Oil, the French oil company. Yeah, so that's not great. This was when he was prime minister, I imagine, to have have the sway to do this. Yeah, anyway, so that's fun. There was a bunch of polls like done on kind of who do people think won the debate, and kind of Macron consistently came out first, but kind of like in a similar percentages to the percentage he's expected to get at the popular vote in the first round. It's not like he was sweeping. Everyone thought he won. It was very much like a 20-30% of people, which is much higher than anyone else. Generally, like, nobody won the debate. Like, no, there was no winner. It was kind of no one, like, there was no disastrous debate performance.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. Yeah, we've talked about this before, I think, with other elections, but there's some evidence to suggest that in debates, you're not really likely to gain new voters, but you're very likely to actually, like, lose voters.
If you
perform badly. It's interesting. We'll see.
If you perform badly, like, your people who supported you going into the debate won't turn out. Like, it's not about changing minds. It's about getting people to vote in the first place who would support you probably if they voted. Is kind of like the main goal of debates like this, I guess.
I'm very interested to see, because France has a very distinct system. I'm very interested to see how, like, feedback from this debate will compare from feedback for the final two candidates having debate against each other. Second round,
One final thing is that happened during the week was the defense minister, the current defense minister, has come out in support of Macron, which is somewhat, this is a problematic, like, issue with Macron's campaign in general, is that he's, like, branding himself as a change candidate with, like, new, fresh ideas, but he was a minister in what is now the current government for a while. So, and the current government is very unpopular. So, like, to the point where the president isn't running because he wouldn't win. he wouldn't make the second round. So, like, Macron being tied in the, like, via support to the current government is problematic, and he is getting hit on it by other candidates saying, like, look, the current administration supports him. They're not it's not a party based thing, it's an individual based thing. Like, Macron is the no change candidate. But yeah, we'll see.
Moving on though, to more European Union general news. This weekend on Saturday was the 60th birthday of the European Union. It's now 60 years old, if you consider the Rome Treaty, the Treaty of Rome, as being the birth of the European Union, which most people do. So this weekend there was a summit in Rome where all 27 leaders in the European Union, so specifically excluding the UK, signed the Rome Declaration, which put forward the Rome Agenda, which said over the next 5 to 10 years, the European Union is committing to 4 major points. Now, this is available on their website for, like, on the Council of Europe's website. But the 4 main points are a safe and secure Europe, a prosperous and sustainable Europe, a social Europe, and a stronger Europe. The 4 main points. They go into more detail on the website, so that's free to look up for anyone. And that was basically what happened this weekend. There was very little drama from the actual summit itself, but it was also marked by loads of rallies and kind of general shows of support for the European Union across in various capitals, mostly in Rome, where the summit was happening. But there were ones in Berlin. There was an anti-Brexit protest done in tandem as well on Saturday in Edinburgh and London and other parts of the UK. That's what happened regarding that.
There was kind of like rumblings of that the Polish government would make a big show of they would demand concessions in this pledge and stuff from the EU, but it kind of didn't really work out that way. Like, that would have been a kind of fruitless endeavor probably on their part. They wouldn't have really just, it's not like they were going to change the entire thing. And really, like, the stuff in most of the stuff in this is quite innocuous. It's not stuff they could now have like big shows against, I guess.
Yeah, to a certain extent. I think Poland was upset because their kind of vision of the European Union's future is not really what's happening. It's either going to be multi-speed Europe or like a really closely integrated Europe.
For the current Polish government is not what they want. Because
they want super confederal European Union.
Yes, because if there was a two-speed Europe, they would be in the second speed. They don't want the first speed to exist at all. Kind of one final European thing, which is kind of like, we're going to treat this as light news. I think anything, also not, like, it's not really news, I guess.
It's funny. It tickles me so.
Yeah, Jean-Claude Juncker gave an interview to the Financial Times in which he said that he's not sure that President Donald Trump knows the difference between him and Donald Tusk. specifically stating that Trump had Tusk on the phone and thought it was, and seemed to think it was Juncker, which, like, that's not surprising information to me that he doesn't know which of them is which. Like, they're very different people individually. Like, if you met them in person, you wouldn't get them mixed up. But, like, for someone who doesn't really kind of care what the EU is, to a certain extent, and, like, who hasn't had any reason to bother learning about it before, and I think we all would not be shocked to find out that he hasn't learned about it since. It wouldn't surprise me that like most like a significant portion of the population of Europe don't know the difference between Donald Tusk and Jean-Claude Juncker's jobs.
No.
So, like, if someone says, "Oh, we've the president of the European Council on the phone for you," you might assume that it's Juncker, not realizing that's not his job.
At the same time, though, you're not president of the United States.
Certainly not. But I'm saying, you're not surprised by this news, but it is amusing.
It is very amusing.
You'd be on the phone to a very high-ranking person in the EU and not be totally sure which one it is.
They don't sound the same.
They don't sound the same. They're from different places.
They are from very different places.
Jean-Claude Juncker is from Luxembourg, and he sounds like he's from Luxembourg.
I mean, I guess. I didn't really know what a Luxembourgish voice was up until Jean-Claude Juncker.
Yeah, it's Juncker's voice.
Yeah, it sounds like Juncker.
Yeah, so now to Eastern Europe, where there are events happening.
Ooh.
So I guess we're going to talk reasonably quickly about Belarus and kind of the precarious position they're in now. Mm-hmm. For people who don't know, Alexander Lukashenko, the president of Belarus, has effectively been in power as long as Belarus has existed. Yeah. This is partially due to him being, like, a reasonably pro-Russian administration, and this affords Belarus, neighboring Russia, a lot of benefits involving, like, cheap natural resources.
Mm-hmm.
This was kind of a more tenable situation when Belarus's economy was reasonably strong and Russia's economy was reasonably strong. However, like, Russia currently has a lot of economic problems, which means it's not necessarily feasible for them to provide cheap, like, below market cost oil and gas, for instance, to Belarus.
Yeah.
And Belarus's economy isn't as strong as it used to be. However, a lot of its government policies are set up under the assumption that things haven't changed. So, like, the unemployment rate in Belarus in previous years was very, very low. And a lot of the way the government is set up is kind of assuming that most, like, there isn't, like, an employment problem. So, like, there's like, serious bureaucracy issues with, like, a lot of their government services. Dealing with the government is, like, quite difficult, and people don't like it. But it's not... That's not necessarily an immediate problem if you're not, like, reliant on the social, like, safety net, for instance.
Yeah.
If you don't have to, if it's not, like, the difference between you feeding yourself and not feeding yourself, a government bureaucracy is kind of something to complain about more than it is something to, like, protest about. And also, in previous years, because the government was, like, didn't have election problems. Like, it won all the elections, and kind of didn't, like, there wasn't, like, a lot of necessary stuff that, like, they needed to urgently change. They cracked down quite heavily on protests that didn't like the government, because they were actually quite, they're reasonably popular, so it kind of can get away with that, I guess, to a certain extent. But so, like, in the past week, there was a reasonably small but, like, kind of big for protests in Belarus, against a tax that was introduced, which was, it was dubbed a social parasite tax. So what this was a fine, which was, if you trans, we're working in dollars, because that's everything in English language media is quoted in dollars for some reason, as opposed to the Belarusian currency, which I don't know the name of. So it works out as something around $245 fine if you work for less than 6 months during the year. However, like, so that doesn't sound like a crazy amount of money. And if you're kind of working for 6 months during the year, the idea being that, like, oh, therefore you didn't pay a lot of tax, because you were only being taxed for the 6 months you worked. However, the average wage in Belarus is $380 a month. So that's, like, more, like, $245 is more than a month's rent as, like, an extra, as an extra, like, charge the government is charging you because you didn't work for more than 6 months. And again, as I mentioned, like, this is like, the unemployment rate is no longer sufficiently low that this isn't affecting a lot of people. This is kind of brought in as a kind of, like, oh, it'll deal with people who are scrounging off the system, people who kind of, like, who are in, like, households where there's, like, two adults working and one of them is just kind of casually working a bit on the side, but, like, overall it means they're not paying their fair share of tax. Whereas this, due to, like, bureaucratic like mistakes and people losing their jobs, this is actually affecting a lot of people. And it's, you know, there's, like, not, like, basically a lot of people who have been charged, like, been issued to pay this tax haven't paid it. So there's a small protest, I think it was, like, around 3,000 protesters in February, which there wasn't, like, a big crackdown on, which is unusual for Lukashenko's government. This is kind of, like, to keep an eye, this is kind of serving as a reminder to, like, in the, kind of over the next year, to keep, like, a reminder to us, if anything, to keep an eye on Belarus, because they are in quite an unusual position now where, like, things aren't all, like, super great, and it can't be all, like, you know, the government will start having, like, popularity problems.
The Belarus strategy was always to, like, to remain within Russia's sphere of influence. They never had a problem with it, as opposed to Ukraine and Georgia, which did, and Russia punished them for leaving their sphere of influence. But Belarus saw that and was like, okay, let's stay, and that's probably better for us in the long run. So that generally means when Russia suffers, Belarus has to suffer with it, and people within Belarus are going to complain because of that. And yeah, they don't really have much of a choice. It's either follow the will of their people and try find other economic advantages and then get, like, partly annexed by Russia.
Yes.
Or stay with Russia and suffer with them this economic downturn.
Yeah, so, like, a not completely unrealistic fear would be there would be some sort of popular uprising in Belarus due to, like, a dire economic situation, like some change that would cause, like, the economic situation to be sufficiently bad that that might happen, or some sort of, like, well-publicized scandal, or kind of, like, a general falling apart of the government in some way. If that started to happen, the concern would be that what did happen in Ukraine when that was effectively happening, where Russia just annexed Crimea and then, you know, by all accounts are supporting a rebel group in eastern Ukraine. Right. Something like that would happen, like a big chunk of Belarus would just get annexed while there was turmoil and while there was effectively no government. So something to watch for the year, I guess.
In much smaller news and possibly less significant, depending on how you look at it.
Well, it's more significant to you, Kieran.
Exactly. Are you looking through it through my eyes? Okay, so I don't think I've ever managed to go this far without saying it, but I'm a huge Eurovision fan. But some Eurovision / geopolitical news has actually crossed over. Hooray. Ukraine has banned Russia from entering the Eurovision contest this year. Ukraine is hosting it this year. And they haven't banned Russia so much as they've banned Russia's act, the person Russia has is going to send to this Europe-wide song contest. By the way, I haven't actually mentioned what Eurovision is. I'm just kind of hoping you know. Each country sends an act. So they've stopped Russia from sending their act because Russia's act has toured before in Crimea after Crimea got annexed. And basically, ever since Crimea got annexed, the kind of visa rule for Ukraine has been if you visit Crimea without the permission of the government in Kiev, you cannot visit Ukraine anymore.
Yeah.
So they're not doing this like out of the blue or specifically targeting Russia's musician. There's a lot of people who would say Russia did this intentionally because like they know what this is going to look like to like people at home. Like the optics of this nationally in Russia is going to look like, oh, Ukraine's picking on us, they're monsters. Kind of thing. So yeah, that's happening. The European Broadcasting Union, the people who kind of like run the Eurovision, says that Russia could like still perform via satellite.
Yeah.
As a Eurovision fan, that would like be subject to so many breaking of the rules of the Eurovision Song Contest itself. Like, I could get into that so much. But at the same time, Ukraine is still like, no, that would be in violation of like the things we've set up regarding like, you can't give like a big satellite TV appearance in Ukraine if you're someone who's been like banned because you visited Crimea. You can't like give talks at universities via satellite, like via Skype call, similarly.
Yeah, Russia turned it down anyway.
They did.
Yeah, they said they didn't want to do this.
It was a weird solution. So, like, the options are for Russia to come up with a new act and submit it. But this happens, like, quite a bit in Eurovision history. I think one of the earliest examples was the first time Spain got the competition, and that was during Franco. So Austria refused to go.
Right.
Because they were just like, we're not going to contribute to this economic boon for like a fascist dictator.
Yes. So, until it was explained to them that the Eurovision costs a lot of money to put on and in no way returns on that investment.
Oh, it does. Stop it.
No, it doesn't. What are you talking about?
It does. It does. It does. It does. It does. It does.
That's like saying the World Cup is a good investment.
The World Cup is a terrible investment for a handful of reasons. Yeah, I can explain this off mic to you, but
it's
like
the Eurovision of sports. Sports.
Eurovision makes economic sense. This is why lots of countries still want it.
Uh-huh.
It just doesn't make sense if you win it like four times in a row, like we did, because no one's willing to make their like family holiday in Europe to Ireland 4 years in a row. Oh, okay. Shush! You're so sure of yourself about this, aren't you?
We're not talking about Eurovision anymore. I'm ending this podcast.
Previously in Europe is produced by Hugh O'Brien and Kieran Dold. The song this week was Encore by Canblaster from France. You can check out his stuff on SoundCloud. If you like the show, make sure to give us a review on iTunes. 5-star review helps a lot with all sorts of iTunes algorithmic magic. It's brilliant. If you can't do that, just tell a friend about it who you think might like the show. If you want to give us any feedback, please let us know on Twitter. We are at PrevInEurope, P-R-E-V in Europe. And you can also email us previouslyineurope@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.